hello everyone, and welcome to the Not Just New Movies podcast, the show where we review a seemingly random film currently not in theaters. My name is Ben Pearson, and today we're going to be talking about David Cronenberg's 1983 film Videodrome. Joining me is my regular co-host, Tyler. How's it going, sir?
Dude, just perched upon a bust of Pallas tapping at your chamber door.
Ooh, an Edgar Allan Poe reference. I like it. Getting close to Halloween. Got to bust out the raven.
I'm going to bring out my slutty costume.
Tyler, have you seen...
Bloody Edgar Allan Poe costume, to be exact.
just to go off on a little tangent here before we actually get this episode started properly. Have you seen the trailer for that new movie? I think it's called The Raven with John Cusack, where he plays Edgar Allan Poe.
I haven't seen the trailer, but I'm super excited about watching it because he plays Edgar Allan Poe, who is a detective who solves a crime based on his writings the night before his death.
Right.
Or the eve of his death. So it's just, there's just like a countdown going now, and you don't know when he's going to die. It's going to be pretty awesome.
Yeah. I think he
dies in the woods, like in real life. I think he died in the woods over like an opium overdose or something. I think
his actual death was really mysterious. Like, nobody is really sure exactly what happened. So I always kind of enjoy fictionalized, like, repurposing of history, you know, just for revisionist history, I guess is what it's called. But, yeah, just for kicks, I don't know. I always kind of – like in The Rocketeer, how – spoiler alert for the end of The Rocketeer, but the Hollywood sign used to say Hollywood Land, and how – the big Zeppelin explodes and falls on it and knocks off the land part of the sign. So just in that universe, that's how the Hollywood sign came to be, you know?
Yeah, and there's those rewritten history books where someone goes back in time and gives an AK-47 to the South, and then they end up winning the Civil War.
Right.
Kind of like that?
Kind of, but I was talking more in movie terms, but yeah. So, I mean, yeah, maybe something like Time Cop, like we watched.
we watched
earlier, where that movie has that scene where the guy goes to steal, like, gold bullion from the South and blows people away with machine guns, so. All right, sorry, that was a really long little rabbit trail there. But anyway, if you guys are just joining us for the very first time, we start every episode with the character name game, transition into our media consume section, where we talk about what we've been watching, move into our review of the week, and finish with listener voicemails and emails. You can always leave us a voicemail at 904-469-6566 or email us at notjustnewmovies@gmail.com. And you can find this and every other episode of this podcast at notjustnewmovies.com. So I've got the character name for the character name game this week. And as you well know, Tyler, I'll give you this character's name, and then you'll have to guess what movie the character is from.
The movie,
at the very end. Keeping in mind, there has to be some sort of connection with a film that came out in theaters this past weekend. So the character's name is Mickey Rosa. Mickey Rosa.
All right.
So, yeah, we'll return to that a little bit later on. In the meantime, let's move into the media consume section. This is the part where we talk about what we've been watching, any sort of cool events we've been to, or shows, or concerts, or anything, really. So, Tyler, what have you been consuming this week?
Maybe bathhouses could be thrown in there?
Yeah.
Bathhouses we frequented.
If that warrants it, then sure.
Well, I've got one for you, man. Actually, no, I don't. A couple of things I've been watching this week. If you've been catching up at notjustnewmovies.com with our Spooktacular Scarathon, I'm shortening the title because of time restraints. I recently watched 1931's Dracula, starring Bela Lugosi, and 1941's The Wolfman, starring Lon Chaney Jr., of Dracula versus Frankenstein fame, which you watched fairly recently, Ben.
Yes, yep.
And I heard was really excellent, I think. Is that the impression I got from your review?
It is beyond terrible.
Okay.
But were these movies beyond terrible? Because these are like the classic monster movies, right?
They were, and I went in thinking that, and I kind of went in with like, you know, that as I go in with every old movie, I'm like, yeah, it's probably not going to live up to a movie nowadays, but let's see what it has to offer. Dracula, as you'll see in my review, is like, it's really quiet. Like, usually all you hear is like the film grain. Like, that's pretty much the only sound you hear for most of the movie, unless someone's talking. Mm-hmm. There really isn't any film score, or, you know, other than screaming, there aren't any real sound effects like footsteps or doors creaking or anything like that. I mean, there is a couple of those, but they're not major sound effects. So, like, at the beginning, there's the a famous orchestral movement, but then for the rest of the movie, it's more of just like close-ups of Dracula's face when he tries to hypnotize people. And, it was spooky. It was dark. It was kind of, another reviewer called it like dreamy, like the whole movie kind of takes place in a dreamy haze, mm-hmm. which is kind of cool to look at because, you know, the people that are under Dracula's spell, I assume, would be in some type of dreamy haze.
Mm-hmm.
But, you can't really rag on it too much because it was one of the groundbreaking movies of its time, you know, as far as trying to scare people. And, if I was back in 1931 and all I'd ever watched was, like, Charlie Chaplin movies, I think it'd be fairly scary. I think it would haunt my dreams. So
okay.
I'll give it that much. The Wolfman was a little more along the lines of what I was expecting from those old Universal horror movies. Music, murder, intrigue. Lon Chaney Jr. was really good in it. He kind of brought emotion to the roles, while a lot of the other characters were just kind of like, in control of their emotions. Like Lon Chaney was kind of on the edge the entire time, which was kind of cool. And check it out. That's The Wolfman was probably the one that I would suggest everybody checking out. Dracula more so. You know, if you really want to see what movies were like post-silent era,
mm-hmm.
Probably Dracula would be the one to check out.
Have you seen any more of the modern Dracula or werewolf movies, Wolfman films?
I haven't seen the new Wolfman. I have seen Red Riding Hood, which had a werewolf in it.
Okay, so, all right.
That was pretty badass.
Yeah, I was just wondering, how these things kind of compared, how these older movies compared.
Oh, yeah. I've seen Bram Stoker's Dracula, too, which I thought was really badass, maybe just because of its production value.
Mm-hmm.
Horror movies today, like I kind of said, I mentioned, the shock value nowadays is like guts and gore and how much, torture can be put on screen that mm-hmm. kind of shocks people, when back then it was like you had to use other methods of filmmaking to kind of scare or spook people. Like that's why Dracula, I think, was kind of scary, because there wasn't any noise and all of a sudden they may switch and Dracula's there and you're like, ugh!
Yeah.
So different methods, different times. You can't really, apples and oranges, I guess, would be the way of describing it.
Cool. What else you been watching?
Three Musketeers. Went and saw that this weekend, the 2011 version.
Okay.
Not to be confused with the Tim Curry vehicle from 1993, I'd say.
Yep.
I hear you went and saw this too, wrote a review on it.
Yeah, you and I actually had a little bit of a conversation about this yesterday before we were recording, obviously. And I think we both liked it a little bit. I mean, what did you think about it?
I liked it. I think I liked it a lot more than you did, because I think you liked the beginning, but then the end kind of fell apart for you when I thought kind of the whole movie was really good. I mean, airships. I don't care that there were airships in the movie, so I just had a pretty good time. I thought it was worth it. I didn't think there was – I mean, it was goofy, and there was some, good choreographed fight scenes, but it was also kind of goofy. So I appreciated that they didn't make it too serious, like a period piece or anything, where a lot of times you try to win over that audience. Like, I'm not that kind of audience, so I'd much rather see – like, whenever I write, I usually have like jokes, even when it's like a period, like in the West or in the medieval ages, like my characters are usually joking around. So whenever I see a movie where that is pretty prominent, I tend to enjoy it a lot.
Sure. Yeah. I think, this movie is like a steampunk influence, it's got airships and it's got ridiculous, like bungee jumping almost by Mila Jovovich. How do you say her name? Mila Jovovich, Bitch. Right? I think her character. And, with all of that stuff, it gets a little ridiculous, I think, at the end. Like, it kind of reminded me a little bit of Hudson Hawk in that way. We talked about that movie on an earlier episode of this podcast where, they take these supposed designs from Leonardo da Vinci and just kind of use it as an excuse to make things look cool, or at least what studios perceive to be cool these days. Yeah. But I, like you said, I really did like the first half of this movie, because that was before all that stuff was really introduced, and it was just the story of the Three Musketeers kind of as it's been told before, but just with these actors who I thought were all really, really well cast.
Yeah.
And like you said, the action is really awesome. Like all the sword play and stuff was really great. And I don't know, it's really enjoyable. It's surprisingly enjoyable. I did like it a lot. I think the first half is so good. Like what I would consider legitimately good, which is not what I was expecting going into a movie like this, that even though the second half kind of falls apart for me a little bit, I still overall really like the movie. So
yeah, we see the Three Musketeers stuff all the time, and it's just kind of cool to take these characters in the environment and kind of reapply it elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
That's just kind of cool to see. It's nice to see once in a while.
Yeah, and it's also...
I
was just going to say, it surprised me that the director of Mortal Kombat and Alien vs. Predator directed this movie, and with as much as I liked it, you know, and I liked it as much as I did, basically. Like, you know,
I thought we all enjoyed Alien vs. Predator. Didn't you start the AVP club at your local college?
I didn't start a club at all. Somebody got me that movie for my birthday one year, and we all sat around and watched it.
Now, I think we went to theaters and saw that.
Pretty
sure we did.
That may be true too, but that doesn't change the fact that somebody bought it for me for my birthday, and I actually own it on DVD, even though I have no.
I think we were trying to plan like every one of us buying a copy of it for you, so you'd have like 7 to 8 copies of Alien vs. Predator on your person at all times. Like it would be like a business card. Like you'd just be like, "Here, my information's in the inside of this DVD clamshell."
Oh, that would definitely separate me in the marketplace, that's for sure.
Yeah. Instead of a business card, a copy of Alien vs. Predator.
Have you been seeing anything else?
I just wanted to give our fans a little insight. I'm going to be watching Once Upon a Time tonight on ABC. I've been, for some reason, I'm being sucked into ABC programming.
Yeah.
What am I trying to say here?
By no
choice of my own. Perhaps,
okay, there you go. Sure.
So you know, big fan of the Tenth Kingdom, and I'm really hoping this could be like a quasi sequel to the Tenth Kingdom, starring John Larroquette and Kimberly Williams, I believe.
I think that was an NBC miniseries from what, the early 2000s or
99?
Okay.
Yeah, because I was still in grade school. But yeah, I mean. I think, I don't know, maybe if they tried to do something like that, that would be kind of cool, but
sure.
They're probably not going to do that, so I'll be checking it out anyway.
And for those of you who are interested, and if maybe Tyler's mention of the Tenth Kingdom just rung a bell for you, and you're like, oh yeah, I remember that, Tyler actually wrote a review of the Tenth Kingdom
that you can
find at notjustnewmovies.com, so check out the archives there, and you'll be
able
to
check it out. Part of my ongoing study of the John Larroquette filmography.
There you go. Nice. So the one thing that I wanted to mention, I haven't had a ton of time to watch stuff this week, but I did get a chance to check out this kind of cool documentary called Helvetica, which came out in 2007. It was directed by a guy named Gary Hustwit. And this movie is about the font Helvetica, or the typeface. And I don't remember where I read about this, but I read about it on one of the movie blogs a couple years ago and just realized that it was on Netflix Instant. And I was like, oh, cool, I'll check this out. You know, for a movie that's about a font or a type, it, you know, that seems like kind of a really boring concept, you know, on the face
sure
of it.
It does.
But I actually thought it was really interesting because it's not just about the history of how Helvetica came to be, which, I mean, it is about that a little bit, but it's also about the total, like, kind of prominence and rise to prominence that this one particular style had in the graphic design world. So it goes through a little bit of the history, using Helvetica at the center of it. It traces the history of kind of graphic design and even advertising to a degree, because this font kind of came to be, I guess, in 1957. So it's been around, you know, since the late 50s, and then it really kind of blew up right when it was introduced to America. And all of these different big corporations and stuff started using this font. And this is one of those things where if you watch this movie, you'll never be able to go outside again and look at things the same way, because you'll always start picking out the Helvetica fonts and types and stuff on every single sign that you see. It really opens your eyes to how prevalent this one particular style is in everything that we see, anything from like street signs in New York City to the American Apparel, logo font, same thing with Target and Jackass, the TV show. And I mean, there's like, you know, thousands of things that use this one typeface as their kind of calling card. And it's really interesting to see. They have interviews with all these graphic designers and like the old school and the new school of people who are kind of, you know, came to the height of their work in different eras in advertising in the U.S. and what this particular movement means to them. And they've got this whole modernism and postmodernism thing. It gets really like theoretical and really heady at times. But I really found it fascinating because I think, you know, being involved in the entertainment industry, you come to view advertising in a little bit of a different way. And, you know, just taking, you know, advertising classes in school and stuff, you realize how manipulative it is. And, you know, as a normal consumer, you don't really think about this kind of stuff, but this movie especially really delves into like the mindset behind using certain typefaces for certain messages that you're trying to get out and all the kind of subconscious stuff that you're sending out to people, and like how this font is so clean and everything looks really nice and put together, and there's no real there's not a grunge element to it or anything like that. It's very like crisp and corporate looking, and that's why a lot of these big brands like to use it. They also say it has this kind of human factor to it where everything's really nice and smooth and kind of inviting. So I don't know. I mean, if any of that stuff that I just said interests you in any way, this movie is definitely worth watching. It's only 80 minutes long. And it's kind of an interesting thing. It's not really anything I'd thought about before, but it's definitely something that is going to be kind of haunting my thoughts as I am bombarded, as we all are, on a daily basis by constant advertising and signage and all that kind of stuff. So this is actually the first film in the Design trilogy that this guy also did, Gary Hustwit. The other movies are, there's one called Objectified, which is also on Netflix Instant, which I plan on watching but haven't had a chance to see yet. And that one, I'll read from the description here, says it examines the role of everyday non-living objects and the people who design them in our daily lives. So it's just kind of
like
the same
toaster?
Maybe. Yeah. I think so. I haven't seen a trailer or anything like that. So there's that one. And then there's also one called Urbanized, which I believe is about like city planning and kind of the layout of cities and what, you know, the kind of psychology of that kind of stuff too. So that one just came out.
Like a toaster?
No, not like a toaster on that one. That one just came out this year, so that one's not available on Netflix Instant yet. But Helvetica and Objectified are both on there. So if that interests anyone, I would recommend checking out at least Helvetica. So
I like the old ProWrite font. It's like the basic word processor on the really early computers.
Okay.
So I would just like write things, and then that was like a game for me. I would just go, what's it happening? I don't know. I had like two computer games, so the third one was considered a word processor.
Right. Is that the font that's kind of traditionally associated with those
early computers? Yeah.
Well, like those games that you've talked about playing before on this podcast, like the kind of word,
text adventures.
Yeah, text adventures. Yeah.
Yeah, to an extent. Yeah, I can't really remember the ProWrite font as of now. It was more of like a joke than an actual input into the conversation.
Gotcha.
But yeah, we could roll with this.
Sorry.
Yeah, let's say it does. Yeah, it's kind of burned into my brain.
All right, I misread that joke.
Okay.
My apologies.
Sorry, I don't know why my voice went so low.
Okay, well, let's go ahead and move on into our review of Videodrome.
Max Wren is a victim.
I woke up with a headache.
He has been exposed to Videodrome.
I've been hallucinating for a while, ever since...
What?
Since I first saw Videodrome.
His brain is already receiving video images. I think that massive doses of Videodrome signal will ultimately produce and control hallucination. to the point that it will change human reality.
All right, so Videodrome was released in 1983. It was actually set in Toronto, which I didn't realize until, like, you know, two-thirds of the way through this movie. But it was written and directed by David Cronenberg, who also directed the remake of The Fly, which we talked about on an early episode of this podcast. So if you guys haven't heard
almost
that one,
a year ago.
Go back and, yeah, that was a while back. Yeah, you guys can go back and check that one out. In the archives or the podcast page of notjustnewmovies.com. But Tyler, what did you think about Videodrome?
Yeah, I didn't realize it was in Toronto either. I thought for some reason maybe like Philadelphia or something. Like they kept mentioning Pittsburgh.
Mm-hmm.
I thought they were in L.A., but I didn't really realize it was Toronto until I read the Wikipedia page after I'd seen the movie.
Well, there's that one scene I was tipped off like in the movie where he goes to the harbor at the very end and he's like walking along the boat and there's something that says like by order of the Toronto Harbor Commission or something like that. And I was like,
I thought that was just a boat that floated down to America from Toronto.
Nice.
Like an abandoned boat. Yeah, I didn't really. Yeah, I saw that too. I just didn't pick up on it. Anyway, really weird movie. Very heavy with the existential questions that I think it's trying to ask of all of us, but just a little too weird to kind of get people to be like, huh, I can't relate to this kind of stuff. Although I do watch a lot of television, I am not putting things in my body cavities. But I mean, I digress. Kind of a weird movie, but also kind of interesting, I guess, but probably not something that's going to be welcomed in by the general public.
Yeah. I think there's, you know, it's a Cronenberg movie from the 80s, so there is a lot of that body horror type of stuff that that we saw so heavily on display in The Fly. But yeah, I think there's a lot of interesting ideas that are brought up here, and it reminded me a little bit of that movie Network from, I think it's 1974, when that film came out, and it's kind of that was like a big satire of television and stuff too, where basically this guy just kind of gets his own show where he kind of rants over and over again. And these people, you know, they talk about like putting murder on TV, and a lot of the same ideas cross over here into Videodrome. So I think Cronenberg was probably influenced to some degree by that film. But this brings up a lot of interesting things. Like you said, these kind of existential questions and what TV really does to us as a society. And I think he kind of answers that question, especially at the very end of this movie. I think he tries to provide a definitive answer to these things that he brings up to us. But what did you think? I mean, do you think these questions were answered, or do you think he left them a little bit more open-ended?
I don't think he really answered any of the questions. I mean, he clearly has a problem with society's dependence on television and stuff like that, talking about how television is reality or it will become reality. And so we've kind of seen that today, but now people are starting to slough off the whole reality television thing, which I think is good. But yeah, I don't think he really answers the question. I think he just kind of has a problem with it, and he's more of like, it's more of a warning than anything. I don't know. I've only seen it once. Like maybe if I go back and kind of, I think it was a little too heavy messaged for me, where usually I do enjoy like some subliminal messages that I'm trying to get, not ones that are going to try to brainwash me, hopefully, but I do try to look out for all messages, because just in case they are trying to brainwash me, I can avoid at all costs. But like it was so just right in the forefront, like the big question just hanging there the whole time. And you're like, okay, so he's going to try to at least deal with the problem somehow, and then by the end of the movie, spoiler alert, it doesn't feel like he's accomplished really anything. And in my opinion, can I just talk about the ending for a second?
Sure, yeah, let's do it.
I think in my opinion, Videodrome won.
Okay.
Period.
Interesting.
Shocked you.
Your
silence.
So you think even though he spent like the last whatever 15 or 20 minutes in the movie kind of getting this reversal of power and kind of using his techniques for his own purposes and killing the guys who are presumably behind Videodrome, you think that ultimately, because he's in that harbor, in that boat, and he's listening to Nikki on the television, and she ends up like talking him into killing himself, that means that Videodrome wins?
Yeah, because the lady, Oblivion's daughter, was talking about how they were using Nikki to kind of mess with him, and then the last scene you have Nikki messing with him pretty much. So why wouldn't Oblivion show up? Why is it Nikki?
Yeah.
And so Nikki, or Videodrome using Nikki, talks this guy into shooting himself in the head, even though he's kind of under the impression that he's in trustworthy arms. I don't think he was.
Right. Yeah, I think I agree with that, because that's what I was talking about, where I think Cronenberg kind of answers the questions that he sets up, where, like, you know,
dismal answer, though.
Well, yeah, it is, but I think because it's a negative answer, that serves as the warning that you were talking about. Like, that's, like, you know, like you said, he clearly has a problem with the way that society relates to television, or I guess related to television in 1983, but still kind of, you know, bleeds over into today, definitely.
Let's talk about the plot. Let's just go back. We've started at the end. Let's start from the beginning.
Well, let me just finish real quick with this, with this thing. But basically, I just think because that scene where Nikki shows him how to kill himself, and then he actually mimics that from the television, like in a very overt way. I think that's Cronenberg saying, like, okay, this is what is happening, and this is what it can lead to, by people, you know, physically copying off of, you know, what they see from the television and the kind of violence and stuff that's coming through. This is not going to lead to good things, basically. And I think that is the answer to these questions that he was bringing up. But anyway, yeah, let's go back. So go ahead, take it away.
Oh, yeah. Well, so you have this guy named Max, played by James Woods, popularized in the film Against All Odds, starring Jeff Bridges and a short-haired lady. That's the only movie I'm going to give him credit for.
I think you had this. You said the same thing last week when you were introducing Videodrome.
So Max, he's like a executive or owner of this one channel on television that offers like softcore pornography, like all the stuff that's supposed to be censored. Like, he offers it in some capacity so that people, he's like, oh, the people that are going to watch this are the people that want all this weird stuff. And then one of the guys he works with is like, oh, look at this new stuff from Malaysia. And the guy's like, all right, let's try to get it off the pirate satellite. And he's like fiddling with things. And like, they come across like this torture stuff going on. He's like, oh, yeah, this looks great. Assuming that it's like staged. And so, you know, stuff is weird for a long time. He starts doing stuff with Debbie Harry's character of Nikki, like puncturing her with needles and, you know, possibly, I don't know what else they do. She likes being beat up, basically.
Yeah, she's a freak.
Yeah, and so he's like, all right, this is kind of weird, but I'm going to do it anyway. And then she leaves to go be on the show, the torture show. I think that's what it's called, the torture show.
I think it's called Videodrome, but yes.
Yeah. So she goes to Pittsburgh, where the torture show is actually coming from, allegedly. And so he's like, all right, well, I got to figure this thing out. We need to put the torture show on channel 83 or whatever channel he has. So he goes on this quest to find the torture show, all the while like hallucinating, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And so Captain Oblivion comes in and he's like, all right, this is called Videodrome, and this is going to make a tumor in your brain. So you start seeing things that are actually reality, because our, you know, what is real except our perception of reality. And so James Woods is like, oh my God, that's true. So he puts a gun inside his stomach. Some more stuff happens, and then James Woods shoots himself in the head.
Awesome. Awesome.
But there's a lot of other stuff in there, because Videodrome is like this entity that's trying to take over the human race, I guess, with their mind control device. And James Woods is their only prototype, their only test person.
Yeah, because he hacks into the signal when it's not ready yet.
Yeah, no, they put the signal to him. He was like, they intentionally exposed him to the signal.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. That's right. That's right.
They showed him the torture show, but he thought it was being pirated in from somewhere, but it was actually a videotape.
Yeah, you're right. You're right.
Showing him the video drone show. And it was just so messed. Like, even me describing it, I thought I could clear it up a little bit, but it just gets utterly more confusing as I explain it.
Yeah, I mean,
because then there's this virtual reality machine that goes on his head, and we don't know if he's in the virtual reality world or if he's out of it because they never return to the scene where he takes the thing off. Mm-hmm. So I don't know what the hell was going on.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things that kind of, it's like the Matrix in a way, you know, it messes with you a little bit and you don't really know exactly what reality is, because that's what this movie is trying to say, is like the blending of what you see on television and or on a screen and what you perceive as reality is getting to be too much for people these days. And that's what this entire, I think that's like the thesis of this entire movie. So, it gets really confusing and really, not so confusing that it's like impossible to follow the main messages of it, but confusing, purposefully confusing to disorient you, I think.
Yeah. It just goes on so many missions or adventures, whatever you want to call them, adventures in Videodrome. And, like, the movie kind of is just separated by the things that he's discovering. But then when you start to think that he's got a mission, like a hardcore mission that he needs to accomplish, like, even that's skewed. So, yeah, to purposefully skew something is fine as long as you find, at least somewhere along the line, find something concrete to hold on to. But the whole movie is kind of in an abstract world where you can't really latch on to anything.
Yeah, that's true.
So you kind of arrive at the fact that, like, okay, maybe I don't get what this film was talking about.
Well, I mean, I think...
Then you delete it from your queue, like I did.
I think you get it, because we already... I mean, I think both of us, we kind of have said what the film is trying to do. But
right.
It's just the way that it does it is really, like you said, kind of messed up. I mean, there's all this weird... penetration going on with this hole in his stomach where they like stick guns in there and VHS tapes and like, you know, give him, I think that's where like these missions come from, is they kind of, it's like the, I don't know, kill the prime minister of Malaysia thing from Mugatu and Zoolander, you know, it's just like this brainwashing type of stuff. And yeah, I mean, it just because it's weird and off kilter a little bit doesn't mean that the messages are lost. I think
right.
I liked it probably from the sound of it a little bit more than you did. And I think it's because, you know, you don't really see movies like this too often. You see stuff that's very easily digestible. And this one goes out of its way to make you think a little bit and also to not give you every single piece in the puzzle to know exactly what's going on. It's more of like the feeling that it conjures, I think, as opposed to, you know, being able to physically connect the dots between plot points.
It really needed a Videodrome too. That's all I'm saying. Like the opposite force, the whatever Oblivion side, his daughter, like you think, and this arrives to my original point, like you think that is, so all of a sudden you're seeing, okay, there's the good guys and the bad guys, there's Videodrome versus these good guys that understand television to an extent but not for evil uses, and then even that is lost in the ending, in the conclusion, because, you know, who's influencing Max to kill himself? Is it, why would it be the good guys? Well, it's got to be Videodrome. So you're, again, the open-ended questions are kind of... I mean, yeah, that's...
I think it's,
you know,
just like...
That might be intentional, but it also may just be lazy.
I think he was in... I think he was infected, and it's not like... It's not that he was working for the good guys, killed off the people from Videodrome, and then the good guys were manipulating him into killing himself. It was... He was just too far gone at that point. That's the way I saw it. It's like there was nothing else he could do. I don't know.
So where does he go?
What do you mean?
Where does he go? What happens now?
He's dead.
That's what I want to know. He's done?
Yeah.
I thought he was going to go fight the battle against Videodrome.
No, I think the, you know, you've got this.
Nikki lives on in the television and the boat.
But that whole thing was a hallucination, I think. That was Videodrome, if you will, kind of trying to get back in his head a little bit. Because I think, you know, like, if you can believe anything that this movie says, Videodrome is associated with this tumor that arises and maybe is a direct representation of this kind of new brain wave or right? That's what they were saying in the movie.
Yeah.
So so maybe you've got something like the tumor being too big or too far gone in the process for him to be able to completely control it at the end of the movie, and he just has to kind of surrender to it. And that's again, I think Cronenberg saying, like, listen, even though, you know, it could be something as simple as, like, listen, if you, even if you start early watching all this terrible stuff on TV, even if you stop, then the damage is already done. Like, you're still corrupted by all this imagery that you're watching and these violent, you know, these violent things. And if you take it too far and, you know, if you go over the top with all this consumption and just become completely desensitized to everything, then that's going to be your ultimate kind of downfall. I think that's the way I read it.
That's too preachy for me.
Okay. All right.
It was weird. I'll give it that, but I don't think it answered any of the questions.
All right. what did you think about James Woods in the movie?
He's not a likable character, even when he's a protagonist. I mean, I like his voice, but, like, I don't know, just the look of him. He looks creepy. He acts creepy. He's skeevy.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess that's what they were going for with Max, but...
Mm-hmm.
Even in Against All Odds, starring Jeff Bridges, he was a pretty sleazy character in that too.
Yeah,
I guess that's just the typecast James Woods character. Although he had to be pretty young in this, so maybe older James Woods is a little. I don't know. I haven't seen him in anything recently, but
yeah,
maybe he's a little more presentable or approachable, let's say.
Well, personally, I know James Woods primarily as the voice of Hades from the Hercules movie.
Me too. But
one, but yeah.
I'm sure he doesn't walk around with, like, blue hair and a black robe.
Right. Yeah,
although he should.
Blue flames, yeah. I thought he did a great job. I mean, he is really skeevy and sleazy.
I like Debbie Harry more.
Debbie, I mean, what? Yeah. She's the lead singer of what, Blondie?
Yep.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. And
Deborah Harry, as she wants to be called now. Debbie Harry is more of a kiddie name.
No, oh, excuse me, Deborah.
Whatever. We're personal friends, confidant.
Right.
Sorry, concert.
But yeah, I thought she was pretty good too.
She was kind of weird though, so kind of the sex appeal that I had kind of for her was decreased a little bit because I'm really not into that S&M stuff.
Yeah, I mean, she puts out a cigarette on her own breast. So
oh, that's just badass. That's just, I mean. But yeah, like, just kind of the weird sex stuff was just, that was kind of a turnoff, even for me.
Even for you. All right.
Yeah. You know. I'm a big Debbie Harry fan.
Okay.
I can call her Debbie because we're friends.
Right, yeah. Man, I think
we've reached the end of this.
Yeah, we covered a lot of the stuff that I wanted to write down. I mean, we could just go through all the kind of crazy body horror stuff, like where the gun, like, attaches him, you know, to his hand. And
well, he looks like Cable from X-Men.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like the metal tube arm.
Yeah, yeah, but we don't need to do
that. Yeah, I mean, that's in there if you like that stuff. Or if you like S&M, I mean, check this movie out, I guess.
Oh, we should mention, though, and kind of along that same vein, that Rick Baker did the special effects, like the practical effects. And this guy, I mean, he's done, like, hundreds of movies. I think he did the effects for the original The Thing movie and American Werewolf in Paris or something. You know, like, he's like, one of these legends in the community. And he, you know, there's a lot of really cool stuff, like, where the videotapes...
pulsated.
Yeah, exactly. Pulsated and, like, grew, and, like, the television has veins at one point, and you can see, you know, it's kind of like breathing and just like grinding around. So yeah, there's a lot of cool visual stuff during the hallucinations that I think is worth seeing. And yeah, I mean, I would say, just as by way of conclusion, that this
movie... Can I mention one thing?
Oh, sure, yeah.
I was reading about Howard Shore's score. Mm-hmm. Which is also featured, and they said he wanted to give, like, a reality version as opposed to, like, the television version. So he orchestrated the whole thing with, like, an orchestra, and then put it into like a synthesizer. And so throughout the film, as it gets crazier and crazier, this is something I read. It wasn't something I noticed. I'm not that good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it starts out with like the strings and the, you know, the original instruments, like the wooden instruments, classical instruments, let's say. Mm-hmm. And then it devolves into the synthesized version as the movie goes on because it becomes like less real, I guess.
Oh, okay, cool.
But yeah, thought I'd mention that. Howard Shore, famous for Lord of the Rings?
Yeah.
And some other movies, I think.
Yeah, definitely.
He's like, you know, he's a step above, let's say, Danny Elfman.
Wow, you're going to put him a step above Elfman. That's impressive.
Yeah, I don't care for Elfman.
Okay. Right. I mean, the dude's pretty prolific. You got to give him that.
Right.
But, okay.
Sure.
All right. Good.
Prolific? Good. Really? He did the Simpsons theme song.
Look up Danny Elfman.
I know what he's done, Ben. I'm giving him a hard time.
All right. Well, let's do some concluding thoughts. I was just going to say that, you know, it brings up a lot of interesting stuff, and there's a lot of cool visual elements with Rick Baker stuff that I think is probably worth seeing. And James Woods does a really good job, even though, like Tyler said, he's not a likable character. I think he delivers a really solid performance. So I would say this movie's worth seeing, you know, especially if you've never seen it before. Rewatchability, I don't really know if I'm ever going to watch this movie again, but so I don't know if I would recommend that to people. But as far as a first viewing, I would say, yeah, now is a pretty good time to do it, because a lot of these messages, you know, this movie was made in the early 80s, and a lot of these messages still hold true today with the way that, you know, the television industry has progressed. So, yeah, Tyler?
It was a little too weird for me. I don't know if the general audience who loves action movies and stuff like that, or horror movies. It's not that kind of horror film. It's more of like a surreal, mind-bending horror film, maybe. Mm-hmm. Maybe a little too weird for some, but again, if you're into that kind of, you know, David Lynch, Cronenberg, kind of that weird psychedelic stuff, you know, check this out, maybe. But the kind of questions he's asking, like I said, it's more of like, hey, we're all effed, instead of, hey, this is how we should solve things. And I don't really like messages like that, because, I mean, I'm a pessimist, really, so, and I try not to be, so I need things that kind of give me a positive outlook as opposed to a negative.
Okay.
This movie's fairly negative.
Yeah. All right.
Although, quality of film, good, but negative messages.
Good to know. Okay. So, let's rev up the old Apple II and let people know what we're going to be watching next week.
All right. Let me pull that lever. All right. Speaking of special effects, let's watch a duology, Ben. Let's watch Billy Brown in FX and FX2.
Oh, he's, good choice, he's Apple II.
Really? He's that Australian / Irish / British guy from Cocktail.
Yeah, the Tom Cruise bartending movie. Yeah.
Yeah, the one with the girl who comes down from the boat ladder in like a thong. Like, that's my favorite part of that movie.
That does happen in
Cocktail. That was someone famous who I can't. That wasn't the girl from Ferris Bueller's Day Off, was it?
No.
Okay, she was in Dirty Dancing, Jennifer Grey.
Yeah.
But I think the girl from Cocktail is someone fairly famous too.
It's Oh wow, that's really bothering me. And let me look this up really quick, because that's...
Yeah, let's look that up. I'm going to continue talking. So, Tom Cruise, like, something about a bar. It's not
Elizabeth Shue. Elizabeth Shue.
Ah, Elizabeth Shue, that's right.
That's what I was looking at.
Piranha 3D. Still looking pretty good.
Nice.
Tip of the hat to you, Miss Shue.
So we're not going to be watching Cocktail, but we will be watching FX and FX2, in which, what is it, Brian Brown plays a...
Is it Brian Brown or Billy Brown?
Oh.
I don't think it's Billy Brown.
You're going to make me look this up too now?
He's not a child that solves, you know, he's not a child detective that solves crimes.
It's Brian Billy Brown. It's Brian.
Oh my gosh.
Wow, we're going off the rails.
Spiraling out of control here.
Yeah. It's Brian Brown. He plays a visual, like
a
special effects guy in movies, and he's contracted out by the FBI to save somebody's life or something. So, anyway.
Opera bar.
both of those movies are actually available on Netflix Watch Instantly, so check that out. And you guys can also send us an email at notjustnewmovies@gmail.com. You can call and leave us a voicemail at 904-469-6566. We have a couple emails here. Oh, also, you can subscribe to this podcast for free in iTunes. Leave us a review. That would be awesome. We're on Facebook, and we're also on Twitter, twitter.com/NJNMpodcast. So we have a couple new followers that I wanted to mention before we get to the emails. At Michael DeLuca, at ZZENROZZ539, and at KayleeUnew836. So thanks.
One of those I've already reported as a spam bot, so sorry.
Awesome. Thanks for the emails there, guys. So so we do have an email, a couple here. So here we go. Dear Ben's Movie Reviews, do you guys allow requests? Because if you do, will you review The Bonfire of the Vanities starring Tom Hanks, Bruce Willis, and Melanie Griffith from Leo and Willimantic? Right? Willimantic?
Willimantic, Connecticut. That's right? Yeah, yeah, sure.
So thanks for
that's
the email.
That's a good suggestion. Yeah. I like that because I've started that film based on a Tom Wolfe book. I started the film but never finished it, although it was a real famous book, and then they made it into a movie and everyone was like, "Nah," because I think Bruce Willis and Tom Hanks' characters should have been switched. We should probably check that one out.
Yeah, I've never seen it, so that sounds interesting. All right, so we got another one here. This is from a friend of ours. I took your advice and watched Ghoulies. Okay, first of all, just to let people know, during Tyler's Shocktoberfest, I reviewed a movie at notjustnewmovies.com called Ghoulies, which is a really, really terrible, like, Gremlins/Critters knockoff, basically.
If anything, just check out the movie poster.
Yeah, it's really entertaining.
Suspenders.
It's a little alien monster creature in suspenders popping out of a toilet, and yeah, that's how bad this movie is. So anyway, I recommended to one of our Twitter followers that he should watch this movie because he was asking us what terrible movies should he watch during October. So I recommended this one. So here we go.
Movies like Troll 2, I think.
Yeah, he goes, I took your advice and watched Ghoulies. As you know, I was looking for a really crappy horror movie, and holy crap, did this movie deliver. Easily one of the five worst movies I've ever seen, and it wasn't even good bad a la Troll 2. It was just horrendous. It was supposed to be a horror comedy, but nothing about it was scary or funny. The acting was abysmal. The ghoulies had no explanation and little relevance in the movie. However, there was one redeeming line in the movie where a character named Dick says, "They call me Dick, but you can call me Dick." That line was terribly written and delivered, but it did make me laugh. Because your suggestion was so successful, I'm going to stream Tyler's suggestion of The Burning. It better suck. Sincerely, Mr. James Robert Dryly. So thanks, James, for the email there. We appreciate it.
The Burning doesn't suck. It is old. It is retro, but it's legitimately good, let's say.
Okay.
Not great, but it's good. Good.
All right.
Good horror movie. It's not going to scare you, but whatever. Yeah.
Okay, so let's finish the character name game, and then we've got one more game that we wanted to play here really quickly. So just to get this out of the way, Mickey Rosa. Tyler, do you have any idea what movie that character is from?
Is that Ultraviolet?
No, it's not. It's actually a man's character.
Oh, okay.
And it's
Mickey Rosa.
And it's actually, I'll give you a big hint here. It's based off of, the suggestion is based off of the movie Margin Call, which came out in theaters this past weekend, which is an independent film
that only opened in two cities.
Wall Street movie about the kind of economic downturn. It's like a 24-hour, one-night type of deal with Zachary Quinto, Kevin Spacey, and a really, really great cast. I saw the movie at Sundance. It's actually pretty good. So if you guys get a chance to check it out, I would recommend seeing Margin Call.
Mickey Rosa, I guess, was now, I think it was Kevin Spacey's character.
Yes.
Was it The Usual Suspects?
No, that was... I'm not going to say.
Reservoir Dogs?
No, he wasn't in that one. This movie came out a few years ago. It involves Las Vegas heavily. And
51? 52?
21.
21? I was going to get there. Come on. All right.
Yes.
52 decks in a card, but you got to hit 21 with blackjack. I would have gotten there. I was going through all the casino terms.
Oh, man.
Nice. Nicely done. I've actually seen that movie. I should have known that.
Yeah, well, you know.
I didn't really care for his character.
Anyway. That's the whole point of the character name game, is to be like, oh, really? That was his name? I don't remember that at all. But
forgettable at best.
Yeah, definitely. Kind of like the movie 21, but...
come on the show.
So there's that. So let's go ahead and move on into this other game. Why don't you explain the rules for this one?
Yeah, let's hit up that game show music if we have any.
It's only a movie.
It's not funny.
You were scared, weren't you?
I wasn't that scared.
Scared.
Okay, yeah, let me explain the rules. This game's actually based off of a frequent email guest, I guess we'll call it, somebody who sends in emails. Remember Holy Cow?
I do.
I think it was a girl. I don't know. Maybe. They did not detail their gender. I'm going to say it was a girl so we can give a kind of a, you know,
a gender.
A little diversity to the show.
There you go, yeah.
So she suggested like kind of like a scary movie game. So, and she kind of set up the rules, and I just kind of filled in the gaps with some answers. And I titled it the Hollywood Hills Horror Movie Game, which is a combination of the word Halloween and Hollywood. It doesn't work, but you know, we're working on it.
Right.
But the point of the game is, as usual, to guess the name of the movie. You have, for each movie that you're supposed to guess for each round, there's three clues for each movie, one more easy to guess than the next. So the first one, it'll be, you know, kind of difficult for you to guess the movie that I'm talking about. The next one may give you some more clues, and then the third one will hopefully answer it for you.
Okay.
The three clues include the year of the movie's release, a character's famous quote, or in my case, a character's quote, and then the theme song for the movie.
Okay.
You know, whatever. A song from the movie. I tried to find as many theme songs as I could. But, okay. Yeah, you ready to play this, Ben?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right, let's get started. The first round, okay?
Yes.
I'm going to give you the clue. See if you can guess this in only just one clue. All right? The year of this movie's release was 2004. Now remember, we've kind of narrowed it down to one genre, so we're talking about horror movies here. This is the Hollywood Hills Horror Movie Game,
yes.
So keep that in mind.
I'm going to say Van Helsing.
Ooh, Van Helsing. Incorrect.
Okay.
Incorrect. Let's see, would you like another clue?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, I'm going to give you a... which one would be easier to guess? Both of the next clues will probably give it away. So why don't we go with the music, the theme song clue? So if you would, could you just play Spooktacular Music Number 1?
Will do. Here we go. Oh, ah!
From that theme song clip, can you guess which movie I'm talking about?
There's a lot of movies that have the oh wah thing going on there.
Oh wah!
Horror movies? Maybe the Texas Chainsaw Massacre sequel? Like Beginnings or something? I don't know.
Incorrect.
Okay.
Now, the famous quote or the quote from the film that I'm going to read. It's fairly long, but it should give it away.
Okay.
And this character says, quote, "Not to shit on anyone's riff here, but let me just see if I can grasp this concept, okay? You're suggesting that we take some fucking parking shuttles, reinforce them with some aluminum siding, and then just head on over to the gun store and watch out our good friend play some cowboy movie jump on the covered wagon bullshit. Then we're going to drive across a ruined city through a welcome committee of a few hundred thousand dead cannibals, all so we can sail off into the sunset on this fucking asshole's boat," end quote.
Man, that sounds like Zack Snyder's Dawn of the Dead.
Oh, yeah, that's what I'm talking about. Coming back for the win, getting the category. Nice.
Okay.
Dawn of the Dead, featuring Ving Rhames.
Yes.
Famous for his role in, I'm going to say Dawn of the Dead. Pretty sure that music was featured in Dawn of the Dead, am I correct?
Because
I think it was also featured in like 28 Days Later.
I don't remember, to be honest. I hope so. Otherwise, the entire point of this game is just null and void, so.
Okay. I think it was. Okay. I double checked.
Or at least the trailer, but.
All right, ready for round two?
Let's do it.
Round two of the Hollywood Hills Horror Movie Marathon. Oh! This movie came out in 1988. Can you guess the movie just from the year? Horror movie genre, 1988.
I'm going to say Halloween 3?
Season of the Witch?
Yes.
That's incorrect.
Oh.
All right, so your next clue. Actually, I'm just going to toss this up. Which clue would you like, the theme song or the quote? Because I think that might give it away.
Okay, let's do the theme song.
Okay, let's play Spooktacular Music number 2.
I don't know if I've ever heard that. I'm going to say Child's Play 4.
Wow. No. See, I was going to do that to you, but I chose not to. Like, just go into the sequels of films. But All right, let's see if you can answer it with the last clue. A quote from the film in question. Now, this famous character said, and I quote, "I'm JoJo the Ice Cream Clown. We'll give you a stick. You'll give it a lick. And it'll tickle you all the way down. Ice cream, we brought our goodies here to you. A tasty treat for while you screw. Let's take a break, cool off those hot lips with our frozen fruity bars. Icy, wicy, fudgy, wudgy bars. And everyone's frozen delight, the lick-a-stick."
This has got to be the classic film, The Ice Cream Man.
Oh, no, it's not.
No.
No, that's a good guess, but it's actually Killer Clowns from Outer Space.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Okay.
JoJo the Ice Cream Clown.
All right.
I think we've seen that, right? You've seen that?
Yeah, actually. My sister owns that on DVD. I dropped the ball on that one.
Yeah, that's all good. It's all good. That was kind of a hard round. That's what she said. So let's move on to round number 3 now. Keep in mind, again, during the Hollywood Hills horror movie game, we're talking about the horror movie genre here. Now, can you guess the movie from the year's release, which is 1992?
1992. There's so many terrible horror movies that came out in the 90s. It's tough to say. Maybe
The Ice Cream Man.
Maybe Candyman.
Incorrect. I think I've heard of that movie, but I'm no, incorrect. Can you play, to give you another clue, can you play Spooktacular Music number 3?
Let's do it. I'm going to say Nightmare on Elm Street 2.
Oh, man. Also incorrect. Now, if you haven't guessed it by now, the quote's probably not going to help you out. So if you ask, I will say which character said this.
Okay.
But the quote is, "We've all become God's medmen, all of us."
Yeah, let's hear it. Who said that?
The character was Van Helsing.
Oh no, Bram Stoker's Dracula.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
Oh.
Famous for the love of a vampire, I believe is the name of that song, sang by Eurythmics front lady, Annie Lennox, also an attractive lady.
Okay, all right, wow. I did pretty terribly on that game. So
that's all good.
I apologize to the listeners, but...
2 out of 3 ain't bad. The Killer Clowns from Outer Space was really just kind of hanging there in front of you since you own it.
Yeah, that was bad. I haven't seen that movie in years, so it's pretty terrible.
The song was actually called Killer Clowns by the Dickies, I think they're called.
Okay, all right. Sounds good.
And then, of course, the Disturbed classic, Ooh Wah. Also Down with the Sickness.
There we go. Awesome. All right, well, that was a pretty successful... game suggested by one of our listeners. So if you have any suggestions for games or anything like that, shoot us an email, let us know. Tyler, let's go ahead and tell people where they can find more of our work on the internet this week.
Yeah, you can still find me over at Not Just New Movies, Ben Sight, writing about horror movies that I forced myself to watch.
Good stuff. Tyler also runs the Twitter feed for the Not Just New Movies podcast, so check them out over there too.
Sure, we could say that.
And you guys can find me on Twitter at twitter.com/benpears. You can find me writing sporadically at geektyrant.com, filmonic.com, notjustnewmovies.com, the namesake for this podcast, and you can hear me also on the Geek Tyrant weekly podcast. Music for this episode will come courtesy of the Videodrome score by Howard Shore, if I can find some clips of that. And as Tyler mentioned, we will be watching the FX duology, FX series for next week.
Not
so,
the channel.
So check that out on Netflix Instant and get, you know, shoot us an email, let us know what you think of it or whatever. So anyway, thanks for listening, everybody, and we will see you guys next week.